So we've now looked at source coding and specifically how voice is coded. And we've observed that for cellular systems at least, we use a fairly lossy encoding procedure, but that the trade-off between the bandwidth savings and the loss is considered to be acceptable for these systems since, again, bandwidth is at a premium because of the nature of the transmission system. We're now going to have a quick look at channel encoding, and again, the idea here is to try to deal with any errors that are introduced by bit errors that are introduced by the channel, in this case radio channel. And again, in general, radio channels are going to be more likely to introduce bit errors than your classic wired channels, so channel encoding is quite important. We won't really consider any specific techniques here, although we will mention a few of the techniques that they use for cellular systems later in the module. So, again, the idea here is that the transmission of data over any channel is not 100% reliable, and so some errors are introduced, so the receiver interprets some of the bits that it receives in the wrong way. Channel coding is introduced to detect and correct these errors, and again, if you've taken a basic networks course, you would have probably encountered some form of channel encoding like Hamming codes, etc., cyclical redundancy codes, when you were talking about the data link layer. So again, at the point-to-point connection, and then it introduces itself again at the transport layer where you have end-to-end connections. Okay, and the way these codes work is by adding additional redundant information to the system, so you add on a few extra bits, and these extra bits in some way indicate sort of the form of your original data bits. And so, once you have at the receiving end, these bits can be used to either detect errors, in which case you'll request that a message be repeated, or in some cases, correct errors. And again, the noisier your channel, then the more such a technique is required. Although, again, we will also observe that if your channel gets too noisy, then pretty much you can't. There's nothing you can do about it. Okay, so again, just to review, typically you have a number of bits and k bits. And that would represent 2 to the k possible different data words. And you add redundancy bits or code bits to those bits. Okay. And the idea here is that you can introduce a greater difference between the data bits and between the entire word, so the code word would be the bits plus the redundancy, and you can introduce a distance between one code word and the next. So if you didn't have the code bits, if you changed any bit in your sequence, then you were still having valid data. If you add the code bits, then changing a single bit will not get you to a valid combination of data plus code word. And this can be captured in the Hamming distance. And the Hamming distance is how many bits would you need to change from one valid combination of data plus code bits to the next valid combination of data plus code bits. And the main result is that we can detect up to D-1 errors. So you can change up to 1 minus the Hamming distance errors and still not have a valid code word. And you can correct half of that. So if you have sort of, if you're closer to one code word than another, then you can correct that error. So again, this is all just said by way of review to sort of get you in mind of what exactly the purpose of this is. We aren't going to go into actual coding methods. Again, I would assume that you've seen something like this before. If not, again, Chapter 8 of Stallings has some discussion of various techniques. Okay. And so typically they divide themselves into block error correction, where you divide the data into fixed chunks, and convolution codes, which are applied to streams of data rather than chunks of data. And so you might think that, again, for the transmission of something like voice, convolution codes would be more relevant, since, again, we're dealing with continuous streams of data. Okay, so what we're interested in for the purposes of this discussion is just to note that we introduce these techniques to improve the quality of the signal, so to improve our likelihood of getting the correct data, and we refer to this as a coding gain. And if we look here, we can quantify this again in terms of a comparison of our bit energy to noise ratio to the probability of bit errors. And what we see here is that if we fix a probability of bit errors, then with a clever choice of coding techniques, then we can reduce the energy we need to put into our signal. So this is following any of the lines across the graph. And similarly, for the same bit energy to noise ratio, we can reduce our probability of errors. So this is following the graph horizontally. And we see that this works in a region where we have a sufficiently high bit energy or a sufficiently low probability of bit errors. At some point, the system becomes sufficiently lossy, so this is towards the left-hand side of the graph, that adding the code actually does not help. You know, if sort of there's a high enough chance of bits being changed, if too many bits can be changed within the same code word, or if the code itself is likely to be corrupted, then what we see is that it can actually increase the probability of errors. But in a region where, again, we have sufficient signal energy or sort of bit energy or low enough probability of errors, then adding the code will improve our system. We will experience this coding gain. So the final technique that we will, or component that we'll look at today, is the modulator. And again, at this point, coming out of the channel encoder, we have a series of bits. In order to transmit those bits, we have to come up with an appropriate representation that can be transmitted over the radio channel and interpreted. And in our case, that, for the moment, that representation is as a sinusoidal wave. And the issue here is that we have to somehow make this sinusoidal signal distinguish between one or more bits, sort of at a minimum. We have to distinguish between a 0 and a 1 bit. And we'll see as we go on, we can sort of distinguish between multiple bits at a time. In order to do this, we're going to have to change something about our sinusoid. We call it our carrier signal. And for any sinusoid, there's three things you can change. You can change the amplitude, the phase, or the frequency. And so we're going to see, again, that energy efficiency is important for choosing the type of modulation, and we will, for our standard modulation techniques, we're going to look at, again, the playoff between the bit energy to noise ratio and the probability of errors, and we'll see that different modulation techniques will give us different performance characteristics. And finally, we'll for the moment, just note that we will have to assign our channel capacity so that there's not interference between neighboring signals. So in general, we'll assume that each signal requires a specific amount of bandwidth, and then so we place the signals far enough away that they don't interfere with one another. Okay, so our basic setup is again that we're going to choose a single frequency tone to be our carrier tone, our carrier. And this must be chosen within the bandwidth of the channel. And this gives us a sinusoidal signal of the form A cosine 2 pi fc t plus phi. So again, we have an amplitude, a frequency, and a phase. In order to distinguish between a bit or bits, one of these components, the amplitude, frequency, or phase, is varied, which is frequently referred to as keying, and that the variance will then be interpreted as the distinction between the bits. And we'll see, again, examples of how that works as we go on. The signaling rate, or baud rate, is the rate at which signaling elements are transmitted. So that's the rate at which we change one of these elements within our carrier signal. Now, it is possible to change the element to represent a single bit. It's also possible to change the element to represent more bits, for instance, 2 bits. And so one should be careful to distinguish between the bit rate and the baud rate. So as an example, if we have four changes to our signaling element, for instance, four different amplitudes, we could represent two bits, which again gives us four possible combinations. And so every time we change the signaling element, we're representing another two bits. So our bit rate then is going to be twice the baud rate. Okay, so you have to keep bit rate and baud rate a bit distinguished. So what we'll look now at distinguishing each of these elements, and we'll look at some basic examples of how this works. And so the first thing we'll examine is changing the amplitude. And this technique is not used often in wireless systems as it is susceptible to attenuation. The second technique we'll look at is frequency shift keying. And first we'll look at two frequencies. And the idea here is that bits are represented by different frequencies. And you can think of that as the two frequencies are your carrier frequency plus or minus frequency F0. Okay, and these are commonly used in high frequency radio transmission in the 3 to 30 megahertz range. A slightly more complicated version of that is multiple frequency shift keying, and again here we use more than two frequencies. So we use some power of two frequencies to distinguish between a number of bits for each signal. Okay. And again, here we have our carrier frequency FC and a difference frequency FD. And we wish to transmit L bits per signal. That means we need to make 2 to the L distinctions. We'd need 2 to the L different frequencies to be represented. And we see this can be accomplished by defining the frequencies FI as we have here as FC plus 2I minus 1M. Sorry, minus M times our difference frequency. And we have an example below. So here we wish to represent 2 bits per signal. So we need 4 different frequencies. And those frequencies end up as FC minus 3FD, FC minus FD, FC plus FD, and FC plus 3FD. And we see that our two bits together are represented using each one of these frequency combinations. So the lowest one represents 00, then the highest one 10, and, sorry, 11, and so on. You go through and you can represent these two-bit combinations per each change in your signal. So our third technique then will be to represent a change in phase. And again, this can be used to indicate one or more bits. In binary phase shift keying, each change represents either a 0 or a 1, so a single bit. For sort of purposes of efficiency of implementation, there are different techniques are used. The basic one you would think of would be the top one phase shift keying. And here we can have two fixed signals with a 180 degree phase difference between the two signals to represent a 0 or a 1 respectively. And the issue here is that we need to recover our initial reference phase, which is somewhat complex to do. So a second technique depends on a relative phase shift from your last signaling element. And so in differential phase shift keying, the phase is not sort of absolute relative to the initial phase, but it changes relative to the phase of the previous signaling element. And so here we use a phase shift of 90 relative to the current signal to indicate a 0, and a phase shift of 270 relative to the current signal to indicate a phase shift, or sorry, to indicate a bit of a 1. And this is simpler to demodulate. So, if we look at the example here, we can see we have our carrier. And for simple phase shift keying, then one, you're sort of at the same phase as this carrier. And for 180, we've changed our phase by 180 degrees, so that's essentially flipping plus minus your signal. For differential phase shift keying, again, the change is relative to the previous signal. So when we move from our initial 1 to 0, we shift the phase by 90 degrees. And then when we move to a 1, we shift the phase by 270 degrees. Another 1 shifts the phase by 270 degrees, and so on you go. But it's always relative to the previous signaling element. It's possible, again, to, you know, represent a number of bits at the same time through phase shifts. Obviously, you just need more phase shifts. And one typical option would be four-level phase shift keying or quadrature phase shift keying, QPSK. And here we would have four phase changes, and that would allow us to represent two bits at a time. Now, typically, the way in which our QPSK is implemented is to split the signal into two streams, each stream represents sort of every other bit of the signal, and then and one is referred to as an in-phase stream, I, and Q is referred to as a quadrature phase stream, and you see that these two streams with the cosine and the sine are out of phase with each other so that they can be recovered. And so just having a look at that, we can see we have our input signal, and the first bit of every two is represented by I, and the second bit of every two is represented by Q. And again, then as we transmit, the I's and the Q's are distinguished through their phase. If you just combine those two, since both I and Q are allowed to change at the same time, you can have a phase change of up to 180 degrees per change. In order to reduce the amount of phase change, frequently what is called offset QPSK is used, and with offset QPSK, the in-phase and quadrature phase streams are sort of offset from each other now in time. So the quadrature phase stream is delayed by a bit period. And what this means is that only one of the signals is changing at any given time, and therefore your phase can change by at most 90 degrees at any given time, and this allows the modulator to achieve higher transition rates, and depending on the channel characteristics, may have a better resistance to errors. So, that's a run-through of sort of the basic techniques for modulation. In each case, we are varying one of our three elements, either the amplitude, which we sort of dismissed as not being that useful, but either the phase then or the frequency. Now, again, because of the characteristics of the channel, we're quite concerned about our required bit energy to noise ratio and the comparison of this bit energy to noise ratio. So how much energy do we have to expend to get certain error rates? What we'll be assuming here is that we have, again, a uniform noise distribution over the channel. When we go on to look at the actual characteristics of radio channels, what we're going to observe is that noise doesn't actually tend to be distributed that evenly across the frequency spectrum in radio channels. So for that reason, all of these techniques, phase shift keying and frequency shift keying, are not necessarily actually the optimal techniques to use anyway. What we'll be starting out next lecture with is spread spectrum. And the idea behind spread spectrum is to compensate for some of the vagaries of the channels, of radio channels. And later on in the module, we'll also look at orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, which is another different way of spreading the spectrum and resisting some of the noise characteristics of specific to radio channels. But for the moment, we just look at basically how the signal energy relates to the error rates, and we'll note that it differs depending on what modulation technique you use. The second factor, or here listed as the first factor, that we're concerned with is the efficient use of bandwidth. So essentially we want to pack if we have a certain given bandwidth, we want to be able to pack as many bits in as possible, get as high a bit rate as possible. And so the second factor, or first factor here, that we're concerned with is the relation between the spectrum and the bit rate that we can achieve with that spectrum. Okay, so we have the two factors, bandwidth and the bit rate we can achieve given a specific bandwidth, and then the ratio between our bit energy and our bit error rate. So the first one we're going to examine is bandwidth and the efficient use of bandwidth within these systems. And for each of our techniques, there's a relationship between the bandwidth BT and the bitrate capital R. And this relationship is dependent on the filtering techniques you use, and for us we're just going to include that as a factor, lowercase r. If we are changing the signaling element more, or if we introduce multiple changes to signaling element, so if we're representing multiple bits per signaling element, then obviously our techniques are also going to be dependent on the number of bits represented for our signaling element. Okay, and so I'm not going to go into in any way how these formulae are derived, but we can again get a relationship between our bandwidth and our bitrate for each of the different signaling, the modulation schemes. And so they're listed here. For amplitude shift keying, we have that our bandwidth is equal to 1 plus our filtering factor times the bitrate. Similarly, for phase shift keying, it's now dependent on the number of levels you have, the number of bits you're representing, and for frequency shift keying, again, it's dependent on the number of bits you're representing. And so the measure that's of interest to us is R over BT, which is known as the bandwidth ratio or bandwidth efficiency. And so that's the rate relative to the bandwidth used. And you'll see that this reflects, sort of, again, how well, how efficiently the bandwidth can be used to transmit data. Obviously, the factor increases if your bitrate increases, and it increases if your bandwidth decreases. So the goal is to get as high a bitrate as possible packed into as small a bandwidth as possible. Okay, and so this table just represents the figures you get depending on, again, your filtration technique. But the main thing to observe is just the trends that we get for each of the different modulation techniques. The table is in terms of BT over R, and so this is 1 over, it's the inverse of the bandwidth efficiency. Okay. So actually, in this case, that first statement is incorrect. We really want the lower the numbers in this table, the better, because again, we want our bandwidth efficiency to be higher, so this is the inverse of bandwidth efficiency. But we can see what the trends are. The filtration technique is important, and for frequency shift keying, our ratio decreases with the number of levels, and for phase shift keying, it increases with the number of levels. Okay, so that's the bandwidth efficiency. So that again indicates sort of how well we can pack bits within a specific bandwidth of the system, or conversely, what bandwidth do we need to achieve a certain bit rate. The other issue we have is the bit error rate, and the bit error rate is going to be dependent on, again, the modulation technique used, and again, the amount of energy that you're putting into the signal, so our bit energy to noise ratio. And obviously, it's desirable to sort of put as low in energy as possible, but we still need to achieve some specific bit error rate. And we can see here that for our basic binary schemes, depending on which scheme you use, you would need more or less energy. And binary phase shift keying uses the least energy, and amplitude shift keying and binary frequency shift keying require the most energy to achieve a specific bit error rate. If you have multi-level schemes, then the bandwidth, that should be bit error rate, is going to be dependent on the number of levels in the scheme. And we see here for frequency shift keying, more levels is desirable and or gives you a better bit error rate for the signal energy. But for phase shift keying, it's the reverse. The more levels you have, the more energy you have to put into the signal to distinguish between or to achieve the same error rate. So this allows us to compare the results for, again, the various modulation schemes in terms of, again, bandwidth efficiency, and then the probability of bit error, assuming, sort of, again, a certain amount of energy put into the transmission of the signal. We'll wrap up by just mentioning a couple other, or one other, well, no, couple other modulation techniques, which are essentially modifications of these basic techniques that are occasionally, at least, found in some mobile communication systems. And so the first is minimum shift keying, and this provides better bandwidth efficiency than binary frequency shift keying, with a minimal decrease in error performance. And the idea here is that you shift the frequency by the smallest amount possible while still being able to detect the signal, and this can be thought of as a special case of QPSK. And finally, quadrature amplitude modulation varies two elements at the same time. It varies both the amplitude and the phase of the signal. And again, it's found in some relatively low bitrate wireless standards, so I just mention it here because you may see it, but it's not terribly commonly used. So, finally, to wrap up, we see that the goal of our digital communication system is to accurately transmit a sequence of bits over a distance, and frequently those bits represent voice communication, although they may also come from digital sources as well. The properties of the channel, so the properties of your transmission medium, are going to limit the rate at which data can be transmitted, limit the bandwidth available to transmit the data, and introduce errors into the transmission. So for these sorts of systems where you have limited bandwidth, we see that channel efficiency is important. So we want to be able to send at the highest bit rate in the smallest amount of spectrum possible. And we also want to look at sort of what's the relationship between the signal energy, so how much energy we have to put into the signal relative to our error rates. And our system then consists of a number of components which are designed to, well, combat the factors of the channel. So combat the fact that there's loss in the channel, and to use the channel as efficiently as possible. So as a preview, next Thursday, we're going to start with the topic of spread spectrum and the techniques we've looked at so far produce narrow bandwidth signals. Again, we're trying to pack things in as many sort of distinct channels into our spectrum as possible. And the problem with this in a radio setting is that these sub-channels will be more susceptible to noise than others. Spread spectrum seeks to spread the signal over a larger bandwidth, but in order to do that efficiently, what we'll see is that we need to then share the bandwidth among multiple signals. Okay, and so this is going to give us some immunity to sort of narrow band effects within the radio channel, while at the same time allowing essentially the same number of users, so not sort of exclusively reserving the broad spectrum for a single user. Okay, after that, we'll sort of retrospectively then look at our RF links and look a bit at where these, and when we look at that, we'll see again why these spread spectrum techniques are important in our radio channels. So that concludes the lecture. We'll have a look at a couple of problems which are going to again explore the relationship between our bit energy and bit error rates and bandwidth efficiency.